Hello, hello, and welcome back to Art House Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make art house, indie, classic, and foreign cinema accessible to the masses. I am your host, Andrew Swetman, and today we're focusing on another classic. We are continuing our series on film noir with a look at 1950s In a Lonely Place, starring Humphrey Bogart. As always, our classic film expert, Rance Collins, is back to talk us through the film's history and legacy. Don't go anywhere. Hey, before we get into the movie, I highly recommend that you check out the Art House Garage shop. I've mentioned before that we have t-shirt designs like Movies Are For Everyone and Watch Old Movies. Well, we've got a brand new design that I really love. It says, Cinema is Spiritual, and it looks amazing. I've talked on the show before about the connection between art and spirituality, and that's something I love discussing and exploring, and cinema is, of course, my favorite art form. You can get that design on a shirt, a hoodie, a journal, a sticker, a coffee mug, just about anything. Check out the shop now, arthousegarage.com/shop, or find a link in the show notes. Let's talk film noir. This is the third episode in our film noir series. First, we looked at The Third Man back in episode 77. Then we did Nightmare Alley in episode 79. And today we continue with In a Lonely Place. In a Lonely Place came out in 1950 and stars Humphrey Bogart as Dixon Steele, a washed-up Hollywood screenwriter who gets tied up in a murder investigation, alongside his beautiful neighbor, Laurel, played by Gloria Graham. Laurel is an actor and takes a liking to Dixon before having some serious doubts about his character as things progress. I really fell in love with this surprisingly dark film, and if you haven't seen it, I highly recommend that you do. If you'd like to watch it, the film is available to stream on Amazon Prime, and you can go ahead and listen to the first portion of our conversation. We provide some context about the film that might be helpful to know before you watch, and then we'll give our spoiler warning so you can pause and go watch it, and then we dig into the film in the second half of the episode. I am joined once again by Rance Collins, who lives and breathes classic Hollywood, and he also co-hosts his own podcast, The Envelope Please, which is all about Oscars history. Link to that show is in the show notes of this episode. And without further ado, let's get into our discussion of 1950s In a Lonely Place.
Did you see Mr. Steele last night?
Yes, as I came home, I saw him going to his apartment with a girl.
That girl was murdered between 1 and 2 o'clock this morning.
Was a lonely one till you.
Welcome back once again, Rance Collins. How's it going?
It's good. I'm excited to unpack another one of our noirs.
Yes, absolutely. And this one, I don't know, based on I knew very little about it, and I knew we needed to include something from with Humphrey Bogart in it for the series. And it was dark. I gotta be honest. I actually finished it very recently, like within the last hour. It made me sad. It's a sad movie, but yeah, it was very, very good. And I'm excited to get into it. But yeah, it was darker than I expected. I think I keep saying that. Something about, you know, this movie was made a really long time ago. You don't expect sometimes it to have quite the edge that it does, right. Even though I keep learning the same lesson over and over, but I still keep getting surprised because like Nightmare Alley was so dark and now this, and anyway,
but yes. I keep recommending these movies to you. Like in the other series, I was like, let's watch Leave Her to Heaven. That'll be, yeah,
God, that one was heavy nice. Too.
Yes. But I feel like, you know, Humphrey Bogart is probably the seminal figure of film noir. Mm-hmm. And I knew most people would say, oh, Maltese Falcon or Big Sleep. But I thought we should do something a little bit more off the beaten path so people could discover something cool.
Yeah. And I'm glad we did, because again, like the reason this sticks in my mind is I've seen the Criterion cover a handful of times. It's him sitting on the bed kind of looking sad, and with this title in Lonely Place. Well, that sounds really interesting. I wonder what that's about. So now I've seen it. I'm really glad that I have. But yeah, so what we've done, kind of done with this series is, before we get into the plot, in case someone has not seen it and wants to watch it, we'll start out with just context, talk about actors, filmmakers, a little bit about what it's about. And then if you want to pause and go watch the movie, which is streaming on Amazon Prime and a few other places, then you can come back and hear our kind of breakdown of it and have a whole film viewing experience with it. So yeah, let's talk about, I guess, maybe Humphrey Bogart is a good place to start, as yeah, like you said, a seminal figure in the film noir movement. So This is not his first film, but he, it would you say this is early or late or kind of middle of his career?
This is mid late. He died in 1957, I believe.
Okay. Oh, this is 1950. So yeah.
Yeah. And so this is only 7 years before his death. I'd say, you know, peak Humphrey Bogart is mid to late, early to mid 40s, that Casablanca through the Bacall movies of the mid to late 40s. But he had been bouncing around for a long time at this point. He had been in Hollywood after doing Broadway, and Hollywood really couldn't figure out what to do with him. He went back to the stage, and he had a breakout role in a movie called The Petrified Forest movie. I meant to say play that was made into a movie called The Petrified Forest, where he played this kind of rough criminal who is technically the second lead of the film, but he kind of steals the show. And it was that movie that, you know, led to this contract at Warner Brothers. And then he again, they didn't really know what to do with him in the late 30s. He's in a bunch of really random films. There's a really great Bette Davis movie called Dark Victory, where for some reason he's in the film playing an Irish horse trainer, you know, which is a smaller role in the movie. So, you know, he doesn't really make too much of an impact, but it's kind of very obvious based on that part that Warner Brothers still isn't sure. Like, he's not a traditional leading man. Yeah. What do we do with him? And then starting in the around that same time, 1939, he makes movies like The Roaring Twenties and I'm trying to think of a title of a movie that's right on the tip of my tongue, and it's gonna come out just a second.
Around 39, Dark Victory, Roaring Twenties, Return of Dr. X.
No.
They Drive by Night.
They Drive by Night. There you go. And then, of course, Maltese Falcon comes in 41.
41 as well.
Sierra. And then Casablanca. And that's really where we get the Bogart that we all know and love. But throughout the 40s, he had played a hard-edged but rootable leading man. You know, he had been, he was the sympathetic lead in these films. And, he, after his contract ended at Warner Brothers, went on his own, made his own production company, which had produced one other movie before this. This was the second film at that production company, In a Lonely Place. And he loved the novel that this is based on so much that he wanted it made into a film. And he wanted to play this much less sympathetic, much more complicated character. So this is right at the beginning of his freelance period after his very historic run at Warner Brothers as one of their top leading men. So
it's really interesting. And so he's magnetic as always, like even at the beginning of the story. It kind of opens with him driving around at night, and you see his kind of violent tendencies right at the beginning, not knowing yet how much of a part of the story that's going to be. But yeah, it's amazing. I mean, anytime he pops up on the screen. It's just like, he's so magnetic and so likable. And so it's conflicting feeling watching him play this character who, is he good? Is he bad? It really plays with that. And you don't really know what's going on, like his motivations. And there's a lot of questions left hanging till kind of the very end. So yes, a very interesting role from him, and one that I really liked. You know who I loved in this film is Gloria Graham, who I don't know if I've seen her in anything else. I was about to look and see, but
you have.
She was incredible.
You definitely have seen her in something else, because I know you've seen It's a Wonderful Life.
Oh, of course. Yeah, I didn't realize.
And she plays Violet in It's a Wonderful Life. You know, the girl, okay. That they have the great line, I just wear this when I don't care how I look, and then yeah. The car.
Wow. Yeah, okay.
And she also is in Oklahoma, okay. Where she plays Ado Annie. She made quite a few movies in the late 40s and 50s, including a few film noirs. Also, a movie for which she won an Oscar for supporting actress called The Bad and the Beautiful. Mm-hmm. Which is a really dark, another dark Hollywood story. She plays a producer's wife in the film, or a writer's wife, a writer or a producer's wife. One of the two.
One of those.
And then there's also a movie from that same year, I think it's 52, called The Big Heat, where she plays a woman who, this is a tremendous spoiler, so if people don't want to hear this... Fast forward, she gets disfigured because she's a mole, a gangster's mole, and she gets disfigured when the guy throws a pot of scalding hot coffee on her face.
Wow.
Yeah, another really dark moment in film. But she became kind of known for these film noirs, but her personal life is perhaps 20 times more fascinating than anything she ever did on screen, as great as she is in this movie. She was married to Nicholas Ray at the time they were filming. Okay. Nicholas Ray directed the film. And that marriage was already in trouble, and they stopped living together during the course of this film. And then they would get back together and break up again. And then later on, she would marry his son.
Wow.
Who she was caught in bed with while she was married to Nicholas Ray, and the son was a teenager.
Wow, what a scandal. My goodness.
Yeah. Then she was married to the son for like 10 years, and they had two kids. So I think two kids. Don't quote me on that. So they had kids though. And anyway, so she also got a lot of early forms of plastic surgery throughout her life because she was so insecure about her looks. Mm. She would put tissue underneath her top lip
filler kind of thing. Yeah.
To kind of make her lips puffier. So you might know some puffiness in some of the movies that you watch with her. And she repeatedly had surgeries to fix what she thought was wrong there. And anyway, she would later go on to have some other relationships, but she died of cancer in, I believe, about 1980.
I was looking at 1981. Yeah.
1981. Telling me. And a few years ago, there was a movie made about her that got a lot of... awards attention, although it fell short of getting a Best Actress nomination for Annette Bening, called Film Stars Don't Die in Liverpool. That's a movie about Gloria Graham's later years with Annette Bening playing the part. So how
interesting. Wow. Well, yeah, I knew very little about her. It's interesting. Like, I always think about Humphrey Bogart, obviously. What a storied face and all that, but his voice is so great. I feel like her voice was also incredible. Just listening to this movie back and forth, like, God, these are such great voices. That's very interesting. Well,
and knowing all about, those layers, I mean, like, let me just add a couple layers to this too. You know, that was, obviously very sordid past for Gloria Graham and sordid future, because we're like right in the middle of all that happening when she films this. But in addition to that, you know, Humphrey Bogart, Lauren Bacall was obviously his last wife, his longest marriage, I believe like 44 or so to 44, 45, somewhere in there, to his death in 57. They had two children, all reports, very happy marriage. But there was a film essay that I saw was written by the silent actress Louise Brooks about this movie. She knew Humphrey Bogart, and she said that this film was closest to his personality and that he was known to occasionally have these violent outbursts. Now, he was, right before he was married to Laura Bacall, he was married to another actress who wasn't a big name, but they were married for quite a while, and they were known for having like drunken brawls. And that wife was known for being an alcoholic who caused lots of problems. I think her name is Mayo Method or something like that. I'm recalling from memory, so some of these names may be incorrect, but
that's fascinating to hear that this is somewhat like his real personality, because this the character
by allegedly that's one
allegedly,
person
allegedly
that. Yeah,
yes,
sure. Bacall would take issue.
The violent tendencies are such a part of the character, and later in the film, one of the his agent Mel says something like, "That's just as much a part of him as the color of his eyes," or something like, "You can't, if you want to be with this person, you have to take that too," basically, which sounds healthy, right? But it's
sounds very healthy, yeah. But I mean, you know, knowing that these people, in retrospects, were perhaps quite complex. I mean, obviously Bogart was pretty well liked. I don't know where Louise Brooks got all of her information. Because I just want to clarify, that's one person saying that. Lots of other people seem to say he was a good dude, and that the drunken brawls were on the onus of his wife in that third marriage, third of four marriages. But because it's Hollywood in the 30s and 40s, you can't marry just once. But that said, knowing that he perhaps had a complex history, knowing that Gloria Graham most certainly had a complex history, kind of adds some layers to the story, just because of how very, very dark it is.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's interesting that he read the book and thought, "I got to play that character." Like maybe he felt some kinship or something. I'm speculating probably too much, but that is interesting. Well, let's talk about. You have something
to say. One second. Okay. Yes, you should know that when she began the affair with the stepson, who she later married, I just clarified this. He was 13 years old.
13 years old.
Caught in bed with him when he was 13.
That's wow. I don't know what to say to that.
Affair is probably the wrong. The only reason that I'm using the word affair is just because they get married later. But even still, that's a Mary Kay Letourneau situation. And
that's pretty intense. Wow. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I thought the movie was dark. Good God.
I mean, like their lives are even. And Nicholas Ray, of course, was a director who, if you don't know his name, he was extremely prolific during this period. He also made a movie called Rebel Without a Cause a few years later that, redefined what teens looked like, essentially. Is probably one of the most important cultural moments in history, just by James Dean's Jacket alone. He was prolific and made quite a few really, really great movies.
Yeah, definitely. It's one of those names that I always hear, and I'm like, okay, yeah, I know a handful of things at least. But yeah, like They Live by Night was him. And of course, this one.
He made that a Western called Johnny Guitar with Joan Crawford that's really fun and edgy. He was really the 50s was his hotbed period, but he was just known for these kind of angsty, edgy films.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's all good stuff and good to know. For anyone who has not seen it, a little teaser of the plot maybe is Humphrey Bogart, as we've mentioned, he plays a character with some violent tendencies named Dixon Steele. He is a screenwriter. It's a great name, Dixon Steele. He's a screenwriter. He's sort of at the beginning of the story, you could say washed up, I guess, hasn't had a hit in a while, and gets hired to adapt this book. He meets a coat girl who's read it and wants basically her help. He invites her over and he's like, tell me what happens because I don't want to read it, basically, if it's not going to be good. And then she leaves his house and find out the next morning she's been murdered. And there's a lot of question about what happened, obviously. And at the same time, Gloria Graham is his neighbor who's seen him around. They meet kind of at the same time and a relationship develops there. And that's probably all you need to know going into the movie, but that's kind of the basic setup. And it gets very dark. It gets very twisty and it gets just more morbid than I expected, more than anything, I think. But
It really does. By the way, a lot of the movie takes place at this apartment complex because, of course, Gloria Graham is her character's a neighbor of Humphrey Bogart in the movie, and they have this lovely, like, very Hollywood courtyard apartment building, which either is based on or was filmed at, depending, you know, like, I think clearly a lot of it was recreated in a soundstage, but the location is on Harper Avenue and Fountain Avenue. In West Hollywood, which is just about a mile from where I'm recording this right now. Cool. And a few years ago, some friends of mine and I don't know, we had like an afternoon where we just like checked off a bunch of locations that have been used in movies. And we stopped by this one and somebody let us in the courtyard and then told us all these stories about how like supposedly James Dean and Marilyn Monroe and all these other people had lived there before. Wow. And it's retained this look about it. It has a very old Hollywood look and it's the coolest little courtyard building.
It's a great setting for the film. That's so cool. That
Harper and Fountain, in case anybody's visiting and you want to see the exterior. Yeah. Right on the corner of the intersection. So
that's great. Yeah. Well, that's probably enough context, so if you haven't seen it, go watch it. We're about to get into more stories detailing stuff. Dropping in quickly to say, don't forget to check out our Patreon. The Patreon gets you ad-free episodes for the low price of $3 a month, or for just $6 a month, you can also get extended podcast episodes, bonus episodes, and videos of all the guest discussions I have on the show, like the one you're listening to now. I've had a great time with the bonus episodes as well, which are open-ended discussions of films and TV, old and new. On recent bonus episodes, we've talked about films like The Secret of Kells, the recent A24 horror film X, and TV shows like Severance, Pam and Tommy, and The After Party. Make sure to visit patreon.com/arthousegarage or find the link in the show notes to check those out. Okay, back to the show. Spoilers, I guess, is the word. It always feels weird talking about spoilers with a really old movie, but yeah, we're going to talk about like the ending and stuff. So, I guess we can talk a little bit more details about the film. So yes, it's quite steamy, more than I expected too at the beginning. So they meet at the police station, actually. So like he's been called in for questioning, and it's so smart how the script plays it. They're like, why are you not more upset that this woman has been murdered? Like he's kind of making jokes about it and stuff. It's like, oh, he's a screenwriter. He writes these murder stories. He's used to this kind of thing. It's kind of the thing. But then he also makes jokes in a way that he could be implicated, basically. And it's like, you're not helping yourself here, but because of that, it plays it so well that it keeps the audience guessing too about could he actually be guilty. But yeah, anyway, they meet and like they've seen each other across the courtyard, and he says something like, "Yeah, I've seen her. She was watching out her window in her negligee or something." And then a moment later, she says, "Yeah, I saw him too. I really liked his face." And it's like they're like really getting pretty flirty right here in front of everybody.
By the way.
And yeah. And then it only continues to get steamier before it gets darker, I guess. But I liked that about it as well. But yeah, so this woman has been murdered. So some of that's just the dark things that were surprisingly dark. So her body's been found in a canyon where it's clear that she's been thrown out of a car. And I think the first scene that was really great was when one of the detectives that's working on it is like an old friend of his. He invites him over for dinner and he basically like they're talking about the murder case and he gets the detective and his wife to act it out. Like pretend you're sitting in a car here and he sort of directs them almost like a film director in this little scene. And he gets really into it and he's like, and you like the way it feels when you choke the life out of her. And like the light on his face as he's like saying this, he's like going a little bit insane. And the wife is actually like, stop choking me. You're choking me too much. And he like has insights into the case that they hadn't been able to figure out. But he's like, well, of course she was still alive when they got in the car. He would have put her in the trunk. And the detective was like, I never thought of that. And like there was no hand mark, so it must have been that he choked her with his forearm. And so like they're acting that out. So he's like helping the detectives with the case. But it's like, oh, why do you know so much about this? And he continues to make a few little jokes that kind of could implicate him more specifically. But yeah, that scene was the first time I was like, wow. This is really going to go there. So that was pretty interesting.
Does not hold punches. It's funny too, because I guess we're getting into spoilers now. Apparently yeah. The ending was originally supposed to be, was supposed to have him killing her.
I wondered that because I really thought he was going to in that moment.
And then immediately like the detective walks in on him, he gets arrested mm-hmm. and that would have been the end of the film. But, the either the director or the screenwriter, I want to get this right because I just had this pulled up. I just couldn't believe the ending that Bundy, that screenwriter Andrew Salt apparently he went by Bundy, and I had written, I shot it. This is Nicholas Ray talking. I shot it because it was my obligation to do it. Then I kicked everybody off stage, but Bogart, Art Smith, and Gloria, and we improvised the ending as it is now. In the original ending, we had ribbons, so it was all tied up into a very neat package with Lovejoy coming in and arresting him as he was writing the last lines, having killed Gloria. Huh? I thought, shit, I can't do that. I just can't do it. Romances don't have to end that way. Marriages don't have to end that way. They don't have to end in violence. Let the audience make up its own mind what's going to happen to Bogey when he goes outside the apartment.
Wow, interesting. What a Boy Scout to do that. That's interesting. Well, it's interesting that they improvised that because I thought you were going to say like the studio thought it was too dark and made them change it. Like what we
that's
had
what
with
Nightmare
Alley. And that's kind of what it feels like.
We can't make Bogart a murderer. That's the way right.
But if he had killed her, I almost liked that ending better because it kind of ties it up into a nice like self-fulfilling prophecy. Like you're accused of this and people are afraid of you because they think you might be capable of this. And then you're actually driven to it in the last scene. I think that would have been great. I like the ending that we get to. But
as it stands, that could still happen. Because
I guess that's true.
Because it's ambiguous.
That's true. He runs off into the street and that's it.
Yeah, because, they could see each other again. We don't know if that's the... They have a very toxic relationship. This doesn't mean that... nobody moved yet.
Right.
She hasn't gone to New York yet. There's no telling... Mm-hmm. There's no telling what could happen, so... Yeah.
Oh, that was a great line, too, by the way, in that final scene when he finally gets the phone call about the canceled flight. And he's like, I'll give her the message. Your flight's been canceled. And he like says it a few times. That was such a great just character moment. And just a really well-written movie.
My favorite line of dialogue ever is in this movie, actually.
Yes. Yeah. You told me that before, but yeah.
Yes. And I'll say it again. I think I said it before, but it's a line of dialogue. That's a line of dialogue that he wants to get into a script.
The movie within the movie.
Mm-hmm. The movie within the movie. And he hasn't figured out where he's going to put it. But the line is, I was born when she kissed me. I died when she left me. I lived a few weeks while she loved me.
Mm. Ugh. It's so good.
It's so good. Yeah.
and he has her repeat it back, and then she throws that out at the end. That's kind of the final little moment.
It just ties everything. It ties everything. But I mean, like, I gotta say, like, as a writer, as somebody who makes his living typing, I feel I am not a violent person, but I understand the angst and intensity of his character, to where he's almost not completely unsympathetic, because I completely understand his artistic frustration throughout the entire movie. I don't know how unhealthy that is, but but even like the intensity with which he views relationships, I feel like anybody who is a creative in some way or another understands how you can take a relationship here and everything is romanticized, everything is built up, everything is heightened. And I think that this movie does a great job of capturing that that artistic sensibility of a constantly heightened reality.
Yeah, that's good. And I really like all the sort of meta aspects of it, because of the film within the film stuff. But yeah, like you're saying, he once he's in this relationship with her, he finally is able to write again, and like can't stop, and she's like, you have to stop and go to bed, but
it isn't healthy.
Happy, right? Yeah,
because ultimately the relationship, and I'm not gonna say I haven't had relationships like this in the past, but ultimately the relationship in a way is his muse. You know, he doesn't need a relationship for the healthy reasons that you might be in a relationship. He needs a relationship because he feeds off of it for his creative energy, which is so interesting and twisted, and
yet it's an interesting little insight into human nature, because it's like his creativity is relying on it, his career because of that, and so that it also all builds to what he's capable of if it's gonna go away. Like, I have to hold on to this, or
because
kill
if you
her,
can't
right
yeah because if you
everything
can't do it on your own I mean, like, that's that whole thing, like, you have to love yourself before you can love someone else, or whatever people say. Like, it's this person who clearly is not able to do that, who relies on other people, and literally choking the life out of them in order to bring life into his work. Which is this movie was made for someone like me, so
it really is good. There's another kind of meta scene where they're in the kitchen, and he's like cutting open a grapefruit, and I can't remember exactly how it plays out, but he references the scene that they're in. He's like, oh, it'd be just like this scene where I'm here cutting grapefruit and you're talking about how you love me, and so like the movie within the movie thing almost goes the other direction, where they're self-aware in a way just in a couple of moments. All the screenwritery stuff works really well. And there's also, like, at the beginning he's talking to the actors, and the way the actors all talk to each other and, you know, talk about the biz is kind of cool. He gets mad at another writer who he says, you're nothing but a popcorn salesman. And he says, well, so are you. I just don't fight it. And I thought that was an interesting little art and commerce kind of a discussion.
Well, it's also interesting that he's viewing his life as scenes, you know, because I think that a lot of people, not even just creatives, but I think in a way, there are quite a few people out there who view themselves as the main character in a really long biography, you know, and so there's a lot of times that I find myself not as present in a moment as I might be, because I'm seeing it as it might play in a film.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. This movie kind of taps into that. That's cool. Yeah. And I think that's one of the things I love about movies too, is that, like, I always think about, like, after I watch a movie about parents and children, I'm like, I need to go be a really good parent to my children right now. And like, it really can inspire those things. And like, not that I feel like I'm in a movie now doing this, but like it gets under your skin and affects you in a way that Yeah, I don't know if that exactly ties in, but...
But, I mean, think about how much social media, like, heightens that idea, too, because you... because now so much of what people do is kind of performance-based, because they're thinking about how this is going to play in an Instagram story as much as they are about it happening in their own life.
Yeah.
And and so much of what people do these days is projection. So I think that somehow makes this character probably even more relatable now to audiences, because he's ultimately imagining life as if it was something he was writing. You know, even trying to find that line we were talking about, even trying to find the appropriate place to put that line, and then it comes back at the end of the movie. The movie finds the right place to put that line in the movie.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. So ultimately it tells you what we were watching was all a play.
Yeah. Yeah.
The characters were performing.
That's so good. And you know, on the social media tie-in, it's like, how many of us have thought, oh, this would be a good thing to put in my story later. And like, not that you manufacture a moment to get there, but it's like, oh, I have to, I'll do this cute thing with my kid because people will like it. And like planning those things out. Yeah. And it totally ties. I like that. Yeah.
Yeah. It hits on so many layers that really happened decades in the future.
Way ahead of its time.
I mean, really. But it checkmarks all these, speaking to the series that we're doing. It checkmarks all these boxes. By having, you know, it's dark in the way that a film noir is. It has to do with a murder and a murder mystery. It has these, characters that you don't know whether or not you can really trust them. It has the black and white photography and the shadowy lighting, and it has an LA location, which a lot of film noirs are usually either like LA or New York. Not all, that's not a prerequisite, but there are quite a few that take place in Los Angeles, including The Big Sleep, which is another great Humphrey Bogart noir. Also, Sunset Boulevard, obviously.
Yeah, I was just thinking about Sunset Boulevard, yeah.
Double Indemnity takes place in LA. You know, it's not a prerequisite. There are ones that take place in other places, obviously, but there are a heavy number of the detective ones that have these characters who beat around LA. And while this isn't the detective in the movie is not the lead character, it is still ultimately a mystery where you're trying to decide whether or not you trust whether the lead character is innocent of a crime or not, or whether he'll commit another one.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it plays the relationship part of that so well as well, because, you know, she falls in love with him and they seem so happy together, but then it sort of is nagging at her over and over time. But I think it happens at just the right speed where, like, suddenly it's like, now he's like, you have to marry me. And he becomes more controlling because of all the relationship stuff we talked about, where he's, his career is doing well now. And he's like, okay, we have to get married. And she's just gotten to the point where she's seen him be violent more. And she, is like, I can't be with this man anymore. And now that comes to a head in just the perfect way, I think. And like the last few scenes are really thrilling. I was like really on the edge of my seat with it, which, I think it was really well done. Yeah, the script is just so great on this.
This movie should be better known than it is. It's I think it's actually better than a few of the film noirs that are typically cited when people talk about. I mean, like, The Big Sleep's a great movie. I think this is better than The Big Sleep. You know, is great in the Bacall bogey aspect of it, which apparently Lauren Bacall was one of the people they wanted to cast in this movie, which would have been interesting. Yeah. I think Gloria Graham is perfect for this film. But Lauren Bacall was still under contract at Warner Brothers and they didn't loan her out. Probably because I think they were a little miffed at Bogey for going out on his own. This was an independent film in a time when there was a lot of pushback from from big studios towards independent films because they viewed that as competition. Mm-hmm. This was ultimately released by Columbia, but it was produced by Santana Pictures Corporation, which was Bogart's production company, and it ultimately produced, let's see, just about 7 movies altogether. Mm-hmm. It also, interestingly, had a lot of heavy involvement from an actor named John Derrick, who would later marry 4 times, but 3 of the women he married were Ursula Andress, Linda Evans, and Bo Derrick.
Wow.
And he just traded younger and younger every time. Bogart was setting out on his own at a time when, big studios were concerned about their future fortunes with the arrival of television and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, I wanted to mention too, just, I think the supporting cast is really great in this too, especially I love his agent played by Art Smith. It's Mel Lipman. He's so, so good. And there's a scene like he ends up conspiring a little bit with Gloria Graham's character to try to get her out. And then he gets punched in the face near the end, and all that's, it works out really well. It doesn't work out well for his character, but I think that his performance is really great in this. He's one of my favorite, I think, whenever he popped up on screen.
I feel like we should also mention that the character of Mildred, the person who's killed in the movie, is played by Martha Stewart, but not that Martha Stewart.
She's great too in the film too. She's, you know, kind of naive, and I didn't know. I think I knew there was a murder involved, maybe, but I somehow didn't expect her to be the victim, and then it was like, oh, there she goes, she's gone.
Because she's kind of set up in a way that she might be the lead.
Yeah. Yeah, for a minute I didn't know much about Gloria Graham, and I was like, I didn't think that was Gloria Graham, but is she going to be the romantic lead here? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I felt. Well, yeah. This movie is quite good. What else do we need to discuss about In a Lonely Place before we wrap things up, you think?
I think that this is one of the quintessential film noirs. If you're looking to get a little deeper into a film movement that is often discussed in film circles and certainly is famous for the ways that it's inspired filmmakers continually through the years, in a way this may have been the first film movement that was really discussed in academia as something serious, because this is what those early filmmakers, those early new wave filmmakers, Coppola and Scorsese and Roman Polanski, you know, all of those directors coming up in the 60s and 70s, they were largely paying homage, which we will get into more with our next movie. Two movies like In a Lonely Place and two actors like Bogart. And this was not a hugely successful film upon release. This wasn't something that I think audiences really wanted to see out of somebody who was a huge box office star at the time. You know, playing a dark character wasn't exactly what they wanted to see from Bogart. I mean, he played dark characters, but they didn't want to see somebody who was a potential murderer out of him. But and I think that this movie really, really speaks to audiences of today. It has a through line that goes to HBO shows like True Detective, and has a darkness about it that I think that audiences today would really appreciate. And it's definitely something I would like to see discussed more and rediscovered. So maybe this podcast right now,
this is going to do it.
Can help that happen. It definitely is on the Criterion edition.
There's a Criterion Blu-ray, so it's got a nice special edition out there. You know, when you're talking about like influential stuff, I thought about the movie Barton Fink, the Coen Brothers movie. I think shares some DNA. We got this screenwriter in this kind of dark world. That's a wild movie, but
it's a really specific subgenre, you know, of movies about screenwriters.
Like the madness of screenwriters.
But I mean, it's interesting how much that does come up in noir, because again, Sunset Boulevard is about a down on his luck screenwriter, you know, and
an actress.
Which
we haven't said, but Gloria Graham's character is an actress. It kind of also.
Yes. Not had much luck.
Good roles. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's just interesting how during the bulk of this movement during the 40s and 50s, you know, a lot of these movies takes place in Los Angeles, so it makes sense that you would use people who are in the industry as characters. But it's interesting how much of this is self-referential and how much is in its own way an analysis of the industry in that is making the film. So there's a lot to unpack here, and certainly much to enjoy.
Yes. Well, that is In a Lonely Place. Again, streaming. It's like on Amazon Prime, and it's also on, I think, like Tubi and Crackle and some of those kind of lesser things, but you can watch it there. But then also, there is a Criterion edition disc. Highly recommended by both of us. Very, very good movie. And let's talk about next time. We are going to change gears a little bit and look at a slightly more modern film. With
a
Chinatown.
Neo-noir.
Yes, a neo-noir. Chinatown starring Jack Nicholson, which I have seen, but it's been a long time. I watched it in college, so I don't know how many years ago was that now. We don't have to talk about that. But it's been a while, and I don't remember a lot about it. So I'm excited to check it out again.
Graduated in a different decade, so...
Yeah, where that one is streaming, because I know that it is, because that's part of why I chose it. I think it's on like Netflix or something.
It's on either Netflix or HBO Max, maybe.
It is on HBO Max, yes. So you can watch it on HBO Max. Actually, it's on Canopy, which is the free library one. It's on Hoopla, which is also a library one, Cinemax. So anyway, it's in a few different places, but HBO is probably the most prominent there. But actually, I've been getting a lot of talk Canopy about... lately. But go ahead.
Yeah, you want to talk about an L.A. film.
Yeah.
Chinatown is one of the ultimate L.A. movies. So I look forward to breaking that aspect of this film down.
And I'm always excited to watch something with Jack Nicholson, because I feel like it's been a while since I watched a Jack Nicholson movie. The image I have in my head that I remember of this is just him with his bandaged nose, because he gets injured in some way. But anyway, we will talk about Chinatown next time, and that will actually be our final of the film noir series. I really enjoyed doing these, and I'm excited to get into that one with you next time. All right. Well, I guess then we can say bye-bye for now, and we will talk to you in a couple of weeks. Thanks so much, Rance.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Great. As always, thank you to Rance Collins for all his insights. I feel so lucky to know him and to be able to get him on the show as much as I do. Looking ahead at the next couple of weeks on the show, next time I'll be discussing the new A24 horror film from director Alex Garland, Men. I am a big fan of Garland's other work like Ex Machina and Annihilation, as well as some of the films he wrote like 28 Days Later, Never Let Me Go, and Sunshine. So I'm very excited to see this one, and I'm planning to discuss with filmmaker and actor Corey Clifford. She came on the show previously to talk about the film Annette, and I'm excited to have her back for this one. Men is playing in theaters starting Friday, May 20th. And then the following week, we will finish up the film noir series with Rance Collins looking at a neo-noir, 1974's Chinatown, starring Jack Nicholson. Chinatown is now streaming on HBO Max. And that does it for this episode of Arthouse Garage. Thank you so much for listening. We've got a few years worth of episodes, and you can hear all of those in your podcast app of choice. Our theme music is by composer Paul Hunefeld. Learn more at appallingproductions.com. If you want to support Arthouse Garage, become a patron over at patreon.com/arthousegarage, or find a link in the show notes. You can also buy an Arthouse Garage t-shirt at arthousegarage.com/shop. If you want to support us without spending any money, leave a rating or review in your podcast app, and that is hugely helpful. Stay in the loop about Arthouse Garage and the films we're covering by subscribing to our email newsletter at arthousegarage.com/subscribe, or you can email me directly, andrew@arthousegarage.com. And of course, follow on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. Just search at Arthouse Garage in all those places, or find links in the show notes. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you again so much for listening, and until next time, keep it snob free.